Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. This week we'll be spending the hour with Amy Goodman, the host and executive producer of Democracy Now! And my sister. Amy came to Vermont just a week and a half or so ago to be part of the Vermont Town Hall series of public conversations that is being held in Stowe every few months. This was a public conversation that she and I held. We'll spend the first half hour with my questions to her, and the second half hour of the Vermont conversation today will be the audience's questions for Amy. So here we go with Vermont Town Hall from May 17th. So let me turn to some of the questions from you all, and I'm going to just start with some of the ones of which there are multiples. So I just wanted to go over some ground rules with you, Amy. First of all, I'm asking the questions. So we grew up on Long Island in a pretty ordinary American suburban community, went to the local public school. Bayshore was the town. How did that plant the seeds for what has been a pretty extraordinary journey to, as you often say, going to where the silence is?
Well, first of all, David, thank you very much for doing this. You might notice we might have a few dueling interviews as we go through here. And to Ken, I want to say thank you for that really wonderful introduction. And I hope you all tune in to WDEV for all the great shows, from NASCAR to the Red Sox, from The Kid in the Geezer to David's weekly show. And occasionally, I hope you tune into Democracy Now! Every day at 5:30. So, well, I mean, first of all, David, I was very inspired by Dave's Press. And even though David is my younger brother, my older brother, Steve, was 2.5 years older than me, David, 2.5 years younger, and then our youngest brother came like 11 years later, Dan. But when David, how old were you when Dave's Press started?
I was, I think, 7 years old.
Okay. So David had a newspaper that he put out from his bedroom, and this went out to the greater good people community. It was the old Xerox machine. Was it Xerox? Where he would put all his weight pressing down, and one image would burn into the next. And it was sort of a glorified family calendar. Very interesting, like, except that sometimes he would write, like, on this day, Mom spanked Amy, and then she put her foot down and she said, no dirty laundry can be aired, because David had many subscribers, our grandparents, our great aunts and uncles, but the letters to the editor page was wonderful. It's where everyone weighed in, and I remember when our grandfather, Saul Goodman, wrote in to David about the Vietnam War. He disagreed with one of David's editorials. And David wrote back, Dear Grandpa, thank you very much for being my first subscriber, but your views on the war are stupid. And then our great uncle Joe wrote, Shema, that's what he called my grandfather, how could you possibly criticize your grandson? And this is, you know, it would become the debate of the family. And I think I was the envelope stuffer, and my brother was the He collected the subscriptions.
He was the publisher. We called him the publisher.
He was the publisher. And I think I was dunning people for the penny subscription per year. And I would put the newspapers under each door. We all lived upstairs, my parents and then each of us. And then we would send them out. And I would send the bills to people. You owe 3 cents you haven't paid in the last 3 months, whatever. But it really was, I mean, David was incredibly dedicated. He got very busy. I don't know whether what sport you were playing or he was playing clarinet. And so then the newspapers started to come less frequently. So we would have double issues and then triple issues. But they really discussed the issues of the day. And there were signs all over the house, Dave's press arrows to the upstairs. That inspired me. Also, our dad was the head, and it's, I think, really instructive now on the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education. My dad was in charge of a task force. He was an ophthalmologist in town. He was a founder of the chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, PSR, and my mom founded the St. Freese chapter in Long Island. There was a big issue of Newsday that talked about the plowshares activists of Long Island, and they were featured in this. He led a task force to integrate the schools of our community. I mean, we lived in a diverse community, but essentially we had de facto segregation, depending on where you lived, which meant some schools would be white and some schools would be black. And he led this task force to integrate the schools. So it wasn't based on neighborhood, but if you were in first grade, you went to this school. If you were in fifth grade, you went to this school. And so we were all together. This was not very appreciated by many people in our community. So I would follow him. I think I was in fifth grade. He would take me to, I think you were sleeping, it was in the evenings. He would take me to the cafeterias and the auditoriums. There would be 1,000 screaming parents. And I would watch as he very judiciously led our community to a more just solution in education.
That idea that you often speak of going to where the silence is and the power and role that journalists can play. Moving to today, you know, when we grew up, I vividly remember the picture that we had of journalists was as fighters for truth. I mean, the things that shaped our images of what journalists could do were the Pentagon Papers in 1971, Daniel Ellsberg, a contractor for the RAND Corporation, finds this secret history of the Vietnam War. It reveals that the Johnson administration had been lying to Congress and the American people. The New York Times and the Washington Post published this. I remember this big photo on the front page of the Times of all these lawyers for the newspapers going to the Supreme Court to fight to allow a allegedly independent media to publish this information. A year later, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein start the series that becomes the Watergate scandal that brings down a president. Fast forward to today, Edward Snowden, a contractor for the National Security Agency, reveals that the U.S. government is illegally spying on our phone calls, our email. And if we were to just connect straight back to the early 70s, we would think, well, this is a whistleblower, this is a hero, he's done this as a service. But something very different has happened. Describe, and you have had on incredible interviews with Glenn Greenwald, really the main, who just won the Pulitzer Prize, who has been the conduit for Snowden's work. But, and this week, for those of you who want to hear some of the most compelling Democracy Now! Stories, Amy's interviews with Glenn Greenwald, which cover two shows, where he talks about what is, it's like a cloak and dagger spy movie, what it took to simply be a journalist and tell these stories. What has happened to journalists today, like Greenwald, where he is getting slammed in editorials in the major media, not to mention being a whipping boy for Fox News and others? as a traitor who should be arrested and tried.
Mm. People like Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And to think about what they did and what they risked to bring out this information, not to mention Edward Snowden. I don't know how many of you have heard the interviews with Glenn this week, and I hope everyone else, you can tune into democracynow.org and you can just go to those two interviews and watch them. It's really amazing. You know, Glenn Greenwald is a remarkable journalist. Laura Poitras is a filmmaker, and I had known her for a few years. We had her on like 2 years ago when she came on the show with a top NSA official named Bill Binney and another hacktivist, peace hacktivist, you know, computer activist, and talked about how much trouble they have just coming in and out of the country. This was 2 years ago, before Snowden. Laura, doing films on Iraq and Yemen, was stopped like 40 times coming in and out of the airport. And when she would try to write down the questions of her interrogators, customs at the airport, they would threaten to arrest her, etc. And you don't usually think about this when it comes to the United States. And then you have what happened a year ago. You have Edward Snowden. This was actually in the midst of the Bradley Manning trial. Bradley, who's now Chelsea Manning. Bradley Manning, at the time, he is this low-level Army intelligence officer in Iraq, and somehow manages, getting on a computer, to download the 60 years of documents from the State Department, all of the Afghanistan war memos written by soldiers and officers, as well as Iraq. It's astounding what he was able to do in the desert in Iraq. He is taken, you never hear his voice again. And you know, in the midst of the trial, and he was charged with releasing them to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Julian Assange, who's in the U.S., in the Ecuadorian embassy now, holed up there in England, and is coming on the second anniversary of that. Releasing this information. The key that was so astounding when Manning was tried at Fort Meade in Maryland at National Security Agency headquarters, you never could hear his voice. Democracy Now! Broadcasts his voice because someone secretly recorded him testifying. Who would have thought that would be such a revolutionary act? But Edward Snowden saw all this. So if he tried in this country to release information, would he possibly be able to release that information? We're supposed to protect whistleblowers. Now, who is this guy, Edward Snowden, right? He, Glenn Greenwald just wrote a book called No Place to Hide, which, by the way, that title of the book comes from the Frank Church, Senator Frank Church hearings. In the 1970s, when Senator Church, the Idaho senator, was going after the abuses and the excesses of the CIA and the FBI and said, my God, we're going to have no place to hide. That was 40 years ago. Now, 40 years later, Edward Snowden realizes, being a contractor, that he can read President Obama's email. I mean, here's this kid. I was amazed when I watched the networks and you had the pundits and politicians, Congress members, saying, how dare this high school dropout? And I thought, wait a second, that says much more about the U.S. government that a high school dropout can read the email of the President of the United States. Right? It's much more an indictment of U.S. government and secrecy and how we protect our national security. And this is what he was concerned about. So who is he? He's a kid who does drop out of high school. He goes on to, after 9/11, he's very disturbed, and he signs up to be in the special forces. But in the process of his training, he breaks both of his legs, and he's not a very good candidate. So he goes on to be a security guard at an NSA building at the University of Maryland in College Park. The students don't know it's a NSA building, but it is. He then goes to work for Dell, and he's starting to see, he's a very smart guy, 27, 28, and then 29 years old when he does this. how much he has access to, that he can spy on any American he wants to. And he thinks this is wrong, that this violates everything he understood what it was to be, you know, a patriotic American. And if he can do it, a high school dropout, you know, who else can do this? And he goes on to work at for Booz Allen Hamilton as a contractor for the NSA. And he now realizes he cannot be quiet any longer. But how is he going to most effectively release this information? If he doesn't show the documents, he'll be called a liar. If he shows them in the United States, he'll probably be arrested immediately. They will be seized and no one will believe him. So he decides to go to Hong Kong. And he communicates with Glenn Greenwald, who's a columnist for The Guardian, and Laura Poitras. He also communicates with The Washington Post, but they decide they won't let their reporter risk everything that The Washington Post has built to go to meet with this person in Hong Kong. It's very interesting that it's the independent reporters that go, Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, and they didn't know what could happen. They went to Hong Kong, and they met this person. They didn't know if it was a man, a woman, young, old, what their color was, what their height was, who they were. They met with him. Glenn is also a lawyer. He had been a litigator, and he questioned him for hour after hour after hour because he needed to know if this guy was for real. And then he showed the documents, and they definitely believed him. And they did this interview. Laura's a filmmaker, and they posted online at Guardian. They wrote the pieces, and this changed the world. President Obama, first they denied him, right, until he showed the documents, right, Clapper before the Senate. They don't have to, these top officials do not have to testify under oath. I don't know if you knew this. They don't put up their hands like others who testify. And he said it wasn't true. Of course, he then was forced to take that back when the documents were shown. And President Obama said it's very important that this debate has been open, but it had nothing to do with Edward Snowden. And they are going to try Edward Snowden for treason if he comes back, and espionage if he comes back into this country. Under the Obama administration, they have prosecuted more whistleblowers than all presidents combined. And Snowden goes underground in Hong Kong after he talks to them, and then he realizes he has to leave. He is going to try to get to Latin America, where he's been offered asylum. But as he flies out, and this is all the sort of problems with the press, challenging the misinformation that comes out. He didn't want to go to Russia. His passport was pulled when he left Hong Kong, and he had to go in transit through Russia to go to Latin America. And so he ends up in the Russian airport, and he can't leave because he has no passport. So he's granted asylum there, and the rest is history. He has now spoken through Skype and video chats in various venues and said, I'm not even about social change myself. He said, I am just about giving information to the American people so that you can decide what we want our country to be, to represent. Do we want to be a national security state? Are we making ourselves more secure by spying on not only the American people, but on world leaders, like on the president of Brazil, the chancellor of Germany, etc.? The comparisons to Dan Ellsberg, you know, at the time he was vilified. And the very same types and probably people themselves who vilified him now say, well, Dan Ellsberg is a great whistleblower, but Edward Snowden is a traitor. And Dan Ellsberg saying, no, Edward Snowden is me in the future from what I was in 1971, but a lot braver, Dan Ellsberg says, about Snowden. So I think it's really what we're seeing today is an establishment press that is challenged Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras as much as, you know, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, who's now going to quit to be a radio talk show host, who calls journalists like Glenn Greenwald a thief and says he should be prosecuted under the full extent of the law. I mean, Glenn Greenwald is doing what journalists should do. You know, David and I wrote a book called Static, and the reason we called it that is because the media should give us the dictionary definition of static: criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power. We need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. And the reason that Edward Snowden is so important and what Glenn and Laura have done is so important in getting this information out and how they differed from WikiLeaks. By the way, the way Snowden got out of Hong Kong was because Julian Assange holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy because he's been granted political asylum by Ecuador but can't leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London or he'll be arrested by British authorities and extradited to Sweden. And he's concerned that if he's sent to Sweden, that he will then be extradited to the United States. And we know what happened to Bradley Manning. It was Julian Assange holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London that made it possible to get the tickets for Edward Snowden to leave Hong Kong. It is absolutely astounding if you've ever thought if an individual can make a difference and the pressure that these people are under. Now, I just want to quickly comment on the Pulitzer Prize. It's very interesting what happened with the Pulitzer. A few weeks ago, you know, both Laura and Glenn were afraid of coming back into the United States. There was so much discussion of the possibility that they could be arrested for being accomplices to a traitor, accomplices in espionage. But they were winning one of the highest awards in journalism, the George Polk Award. And what could be a better time to challenge this than to fly in at this point to get the award? I mean, if they're going to be arrested then, that would be a very sad comment on the Obama administration. So they flew in, and they were able to get this award. So Glenn came back this week because he wrote this book, No Place to Hide. But 3 days after they got the George Polk Award, the Pulitzers were announced. And who won? Well, The Guardian and The Washington Post won the highest Pulitzer Prize. It's called the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. And then other individuals won for best feature, best breaking news, everything else. They weren't personally named. Yet think about what they did. Why didn't they personally? Now, it's a very big deal. Glenn wrote for The Guardian, and Laura wrote for both The Guardian. She co-bylined The Guardian and The Washington Post. Now, the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service usually goes to an institution. How could the Pulitzer Committee avoid giving an award for this astounding series of articles? They couldn't. But clearly there was a battle within the Pulitzer for the establishment media that cannot stand Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, and those who felt that they must be recognized. I mean, what could be a higher value in journalism than what they represented? So there was this battle, and so they gave it to the institutions, to the Washington Post and to the Guardian. Now, if you click through on the websites of the Pulitzer, it shows the articles. Glenn Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, Laura Poitras, and Laura Poitras is also the Washington Post, Laura Poitras, Laura Poitras. So they are these they are what got these institutions these awards. Even with giving it to an institution, as the Pulitzer for the Public Service is, it will often say, you know, to the New York Times with taking special note of the bravery of this reporter, but they didn't name those reporters. But still, you know, technically, you must say they were part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize as opposed to Pulitzer Prize winner. But, you know, we certainly call them Pulitzer Prize winners. And when you look at the other names, there are some very wonderful journalists who are part of it. And they themselves would say, you can't put me in the category of Glenn. Glenn's the one who risked his freedom, risked everything to go and cover the story, as Laura did. So that's very interesting. And as Glenn said also, though congratulating both institutions for being willing to back them in doing this work, Glenn said it was also a battle between old media and new media. You know, still giving to the more establishment publications. But it's these two independent journalists that have just broken the sound barrier every which way and continue to do this. What they did differently than WikiLeaks is WikiLeaks did one dump of the information, which can lead to a couple of stories. It's so overwhelming, you know, who is going to be able to really go through it. And what these guys are doing is learning from that, and the lack of coverage overall, though you certainly know about WikiLeaks, is releasing these stories over time, one by one, so each one has an effect.
We'll be back with more of my public conversation with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, in the second half hour.
Looking for a loan for your Vermont business, childcare, or nonprofit organization? Look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Because at the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we lend to Vermont businesses and nonprofits, even if the bank says you're not quite ready for a loan. At the Vermont Community Loan Fund, we focus on people, not profits. We'll work closely with you before and after you get your loan to make sure you get what you need to succeed. The Vermont Community Loan Fund makes loans to early stage companies and established businesses ready to take the next step. We lend to farms and food producers, high-tech businesses, manufacturers, retailers, childcare businesses, affordable housing developers, service providers, and other nonprofit organizations. We make loans to Vermonters doing business right here at home and around the world. So if you're looking for financing to help your growing business, look at the Vermont Community Loan Fund. Visit us online at investinvermont.org. That's investinvermont.org.
I'm Tim McGuire. President Obama says Maya Angelou's death dims one of the brightest lights of our time. Former President Bill Clinton says America has lost a national treasure. Singer, dancer, actress, single mother, stripper, civil rights leader, and top-selling poet and author. Angelou found ways to overcome any and all challenges. Warren Levinson has this reaction from New York.
Ben McFall, who manages the fiction section at New York's massive Strand bookstore, thought of Maya Angelou as the eminent poet and memoirist, also a living, breathing woman you might see on the street.
A friend of mine was in the village, and he looked up, and Maya Angelou was on the street, and he was looking up at a building, and she just said, "Yo, Charlie!" And I just thought anybody that could do that is just exquisite.
Angelou, who died at 86, lived in Harlem for a time. Angelou, best known for the memoir I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, died at home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Warren Levinson, New York.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where this week we're listening to the May 17th Vermont Town Hall public conversation that I had with Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, and my sister. In our second half hour now, we'll hear questions from the audience.
So let me turn to some of the questions from you all, and I'm going to just start with some of the ones of which there are multiples. So what is your advice for local media makers? What are the essential characteristics of a successful media outlet and journalists, and one that can generate a following?
Say that one more time. What's advice to local reporters?
Yes. What are the essential characteristics of a successful journalist and media outlet?
I think doing the same thing as a national reporter. I mean, every community deals with stories that have global significance. And especially here in Vermont, I mean, you are trendsetters on so many issues. I mean, whether you're talking about the possibility of single payer in the coming years. You know, I always think when I hear about what Vermont is doing, I think about
What Vermont is doing in single payer.
I think
and GMOs.
No. I think about what happened in Canada with okay, I was just trying to think of his name. You know, the premier of Saskatchewan in the 1960s was a man named Tommy Douglas, and he pioneered single payer in Canada by starting in Saskatchewan. It's very interesting parallel, possibly, to Vermont. He was this very interesting guy who had almost lost his leg as a child, didn't have money, and the way he was taken care of, as they said, we will take care of you for free if you let other students watch, the doctor said, to, you know, learn how to deal with you, and he said, fine, and he realized that there should be single payer in Canada. The biggest opponent, amazingly enough, was the American Medical Association. They were afraid the contagion would spread south. And they let a doctor strike in Saskatchewan, but they overcame that. Single payer came to Saskatchewan and then spread very quickly. The contagion spread across Canada. Extremely popular, and he's considered like the greatest Canadian. That was Tommy Douglas. His grandson is Kiefer Sutherland, right? His mother is Shirley Douglas. That's his daughter. So his grandson is the famous actor Kiefer Sutherland. And Vermont is really so important when it comes to that, when it comes to GMOs, when it comes to nuclear power, when it comes to how you deal with climate change, having dealt with Hurricane Irene. I know that Sue Minter is here and should be congratulated for her incredible work coordinating the response to, you know, Hurricane Irene with all you amazing folks who came together and a model in this country for how communities can deal with a, you know, a natural disaster, but also relating that to this whole issue of climate disruption. So you model so many different things. So a local reporter here, everything you do really has global significance. And I think it's holding those in power accountable. Your town hall meetings are so interesting. And we all have the same job, whatever level we're working at. I mean, at Democracy Now!, we often have guests on from Vermont, as we do from other states, because what you do at a local level is the most authentic response. You know, when people tune into Democracy Now!, I think the reason you don't get completely depressed is because the people who come on the show are people who are doing something about these global crises. And that's what it is to be a citizen of this country and of the world, is seeing how people are working together to deal with something. And, you know, that's our goal at Democracy Now!, is to give voice to that.
How do you answer critics who say you are an advocacy journalist?
I mean, when it comes to advocacy journalism, I think the corporate reporters are our model. We know, I mean, when you watch television, when you watch the networks, and I'm not just talking about Fox, you have this small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. Let me give you an example. 11 years ago, the lead up to the Iraq War, I always cite the study of FAIR. 6 weeks before the invasion of Iraq, it was February 5th, 2003, General Powell gives his push for war at the UN. FAIR looked at the four nightly newscasts, ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. The two-week period, 6 weeks before the invasion, you know, this is the time Noam Chomsky talks about manufacturing consent for war. There were 393 interviews done around war. This is when half the population was for it, half the population was against it. So you think, what, about 200 people would be for war and whatever. 393 interviews, quotes, around war in that two-week period. Guess how many were with anti-war leaders, peace activists? Three of almost 400. It's no longer a mainstream media. It's an extreme media beating the drums for war, which is why we have to take it back.
This week, the public editor of the New York Times, that's the ombudsman, did an analysis of how many of women in the media. And I'm forgetting the statistics, but it was a shockingly small number of
bylaws. Increasingly small.
What do you think the absence of women, people of color, you know, any number of people who aren't white men from the mainstream media, what effect does it have? What are we not seeing in the media as a result?
I mean, it has a tremendous effect, and it's about basic fairness. I mean, you can't exclude the majority of the population. What is represented in your newsroom is really what you're going to cover. I think the reason Democracy Now! Has turned even public radio on its head is because when people hear different voices on the radio, they respond. It brings in whole different audiences. And, I mean, that, I think, is just a matter of basic fairness. And, you know, the whole story about Jill Abramson being fired at the New York Times, her last issue that she brought up with management, with Arthur Sulzberger, was her pay, that she had only recently learned that at every level, when she was Washington editor, national editor, and then executive editor, she was making far less than her colleagues. When she, I think it was national editor, Washington editor, the man who succeeded her, Phil Taubman, made $100,000 more than her. And when she was, I can't remember which position, but her deputy was making more than she was, but she didn't realize this as she was going. And, you know, it's why Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, said this is a perfect example of why we have to pass a Pay Equity Act. I mean, people should be paid fairly and equally. And I think that cuts across the political spectrum. I think conservatives feel that way. Progressives feel that way. It's just a matter of basic fairness. And we have to have the newsrooms of this country reflect what America looks like.
The most common question in my stack here is, what gives you hope?
The people of East Timor gave me tremendous hope and continue to. The people of Haiti go to the polls and, you know, with coup after coup, gunned down, and yet they continue to vote and deeply believe. In this country, how people are engaged, you know, when we first started Democracy Now! 18 years ago, and I come from Pacifica Radio originally, and when they asked me to be the host of this show, I was in Haiti in some underground house. People were getting gunned down when they went to the polls, and they wanted me to do this election show here in the United States, and most people didn't even vote in the United States. I think with Aristide first being elected, 90% of the people went to the polls, and it's true all over the world. Countries make every effort to get people to the polls. In the United States, every effort is made to keep people from going to the polls. I mean, the fact we don't have the day off on the day of elections. So, I mean, how do you get to polling places? You have to go at 6 o'clock in the morning if you're a working person, or get there late at night. I mean, in New York, the lines are so incredibly long. You know, same-day voting. It is astounding that it is so difficult and increasingly difficult with these voter ID laws to get to the polls in this country. But when I was asked to do this, I thought, you know, most people don't vote, but I don't think people are apathetic. Maybe they think they don't have a choice. I wanted to know what they were involved with. So in 1996, that was when Clinton was elected for the second time, we used the primary states as a way to look at what each state, people in their states, were doing. And people are doing many things, are deeply engaged in their communities. But it reminds me of this interview I had with, on Election Day in 2000. And for you longtime listeners, you may have heard it. But this is the day it was before we were doing television, which we started actually the week of September 11th, 2001, coincidentally. We're just doing radio, and I was in the studios of WBAI, and it was election morning. That was Gore v. Bush day. And we got a call. We were doing the show at like 9 in the morning at that time. Now we actually do it at 8 in the morning. And it was a few minutes before 9, and my producers had already gone into the studio, and I get a call, and they say, "Hi, it's White House calling." And I thought they said, "It's the White Horse calling." That's a famous bar in the village where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death. And I thought the only people that would call now is someone with a breaking story. The White Horse, this bar is? I said, what do you want? And they said, the president wants to talk to you. And I said, the president of a tavern at 9 in the morning? I said, the president of what? And so they said, the president of the United States. Well, the White House is calling. I said, oh my God, President Clinton? Yes, Clinton wants to talk to you. He's going to call. I said, about what? So he said, well, it's election day, and he wants to get out the vote, right? Hillary Clinton was running for the Senate in New York, and Al Gore was running for president. I didn't know if this was a hoax. It's seconds before we're going there. So I gave him the internal number, and I said, well, here's a number. If he wants to call, he can. So I run inside, and they're saying the producer's Maria Carrion. She had just flown in to produce for, like, the one day of the election. She knew things would be tough, and we had a very small staff at the time. She flew in from Madrid. She thought, I'll come for 3 days, day before, during, and after the election, until they announce the new president. But, of course, remember, this is Gore v. Bush, and this would take 5 days. It wouldn't be an election, 5 weeks. It wouldn't be an election. It would be a selection by the Supreme Court. But anyway, so I run in. They say, where were you? You have to start. And so I said, I don't know. It's possible President Clinton's going to call in. If he does, please answer the phone. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, but I'm sure he won't. Just think of some questions anyway. So we do the show. He doesn't call in. We're going out for coffee because we think it'll be a long day. They'll announce president like after midnight. And I get this. We hear this scream from the control room. And it's Gonzalo Alberto, who's doing the Alternativa Latina music show. And he's screaming, the president is on the phone. I said, oh, my God. So we run in, and Gonzalo is paralyzed. He is, all the faders for the salsa music are up. All the microphones are down. And you hear President Clinton saying, is anyone there? Is anyone there? So I throw my body over the console. I pull down all of the music faders. I have no idea how this board works, but I know whatever it is, it's the opposite of what it should be doing right now. Bring down all the music faders, and I have no idea which mics are on, so I just bring up all of the microphones, 7 microphones, so the room is hot. It's Gonzalo and his producer, me and my 2 producers, and I said, okay, Gonzalo, here goes. Hello, Mr. President. Hello, hello. And so I said, well, I understand you're calling to get out the vote. They had said he wanted to talk about getting out the vote. He said, that's right. And I said, well, what do you say to people who feel that both the Democratic and the Republican Party are captured by the corporations, that there isn't really a choice? And he answered, you know, and he really was galvanized to give a full answer. And he was still there, so I asked him about Leonard Peltier. You know, he's the Native American activist who has been imprisoned for decades. He was convicted of killing 2 FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975, but he says he didn't do it. And it has been a case that has enraged the Native American community in particular and social justice activists for decades. And we did understand that President Clinton at the time was considering granting him clemency. It was the first time he was publicly asked about this, and he talked about it. And then we asked him about the bombing of Vieques, the Puerto Rican island, and the napalming of it by the U.S. Navy, and about I asked about the sanctions against Iraq. You remember when Madeleine Albright says it's the answer she most regrets in her career as Secretary of State? She was asked by 60 Minutes, 500,000 children have died because of the sanctions against Iraq. Do you think it's worth the price? And she said yes. She says she made a mistake in saying that. But I asked him about that, and I said to Assistant UN...
This is when he cut in and said, you're being rude and disrespectful.
Yes, I said, well, 2 UN Assistant Secretary Generals have quit who presided over the sanctions regime in Iraq, calling them genocidal, and he said they weren't telling the truth. And then I asked him about Ralph Nader, and he was running for president at the time. I said, aren't you really responsible for his success because you've brought the Democratic Party to the right? And that's when he said, I find you hostile, combative, and at times disrespectful. So I said... I just have a few more questions. And I asked him if, you know, Al Gore said his first act in office would to be to issue an executive order against racial profiling. And I said, that's very noble, but you guys have been in office for 8 years. Why haven't you done it yet? And so anyway, at the end of this sort of half-hour conversation, or it wouldn't have been the end except that he said he had to get off, so he got off. And that was a very interesting Latino music show that day. So the next day, we ran it on Democracy Now!, and right afterwards, I got, you know, the press was picking up this story, and I got a call from Newsday. And this is when we still had landlines. And Peter Goodman, no relation, called, and he said, I want to ask you about how this conversation took place. You know, people, journalists plan their whole career to interview the most powerful person on earth. And so I said, oh, well, and the other phone rang. And so I picked up the phone, and it was the White House. I said, oh, just one second. I said, Peter, I'll have to call you back. It's the White House. He said, no, just put the phone down, and come back to me as soon as you're done. So I didn't put him on hold, I just put the phone down. And I said, oh, hello, hi. And so they said, you're banned from the White House. I said, I'm banned? I said, he called me, I didn't call him. and they said, you broke every ground rule. I said, ground rule that we had agreed to, they said. I said, what are you talking about? I didn't agree to anything. And so they said, we told you that President Clinton wanted to talk about getting out the vote, and question 1, 4, and 7, I think they said, related to that. But every other question, I said, I asked 3 questions related to what he wanted to talk about. I'm actually surprised, but it sounds like you have a transcript of the whole thing. Could you send it to us? Because we'd like to post it online. But anyway, so they said, we told you what he wanted to talk about. You broke the ground rules. And furthermore, they said, and I said, wait a second. How many journalists did he talk to that morning? He was doing a round of calls to radio reporters in New York because Hillary was running for Senate. And they said, like, 40. And I said, and none of them asked other questions. They said, that's right, because they understood. I said, this is a very sad comment on American journalism. You don't feed us the questions. I understand that's what President Clinton wanted to talk about, but I had some other questions. And so they said, furthermore, we told you he had 2 or 3 minutes. You kept him on the phone for over half an hour. I said, the man is the leader of the free world. He's the most powerful person on earth. He could have hung up if he wanted to. And anyway, I said, I think we'll be around longer than you guys will. And that was sort of the gist of the conversation. And I hung up. And then I realized, you know, Peter is still on the phone from Newsday. So I picked up the phone and I said, oh, I'm so sorry. He said, no, I got everything I need.
You hear, I'm sure you participated in round tables or panels of, there's a lot of hand-wringing about the end of newspapers, about the end of, you know, we have major institutions that we grew up with, Newsweek, major daily newspapers, the Times, Picayune, and others that are now collapsing, going away. And yet Democracy Now! Is expanding every year, over 1,200 stations. I remember when it was very easy for you to remember how many stations it was. It was like the 5 Pacifica stations. Each year you'd pick up a few more. So you have, it seems to me, this picture of one kind of old model in decline and something else happening here. What do you think is the future of media that can succeed and serve a democratic society?
Well, I don't think it's so much about what the platform is. It's about doing basic good journalism. Giving people a chance to speak for themselves or telling their stories until they can. It's about holding those in power accountable. There's a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. You know, Democracy Now!, we began on radio, and then we expanded to television, and now we're on 1,200 public television radio stations, evenly divided, 600 and 600, moving on to 1,300. We just picked up another PBS station in Tennessee this week. It's every week another station is picking us up. And I think it's that hunger. It's that hunger for independent voices. And one I think there is a very important place still for radio. I remember in 1994 and 95 covering the Zapatista Revolution when Subcomandante Marcos and the Zapatistas had their first news conference in San Cristobal de las Casas in Mexico. I was able to go to this first news conference. It was only for Mexican radio reporters. I didn't even speak Spanish. But what happened is, and the establishment media was enraged when I came out and they said, why didn't you tell us? What had happened early that morning is I couldn't afford to stay in the fancier hotels in San Cristobal, and so I was out on the periphery. The Zapatistas were terrified of coming into town. They couldn't go to the establishment hotels and tell the reporters they were holding a news conference because they would be arrested. But because I was out in the periphery in a very cheap place, that was the place that they could get word out. And so I just went to the Cathedral of Peace where they said this would be happening, and I lined up. I had no idea if others would be there, and I saw all these other radio reporters. But inside, when Marcos and the other Zapatistas lined up, he said he felt radio was the most important medium because it reaches the masses of people. I mean, even in the poorest community, there would be, at least be one radio in a whole village that people would gather around. And as, you know, you listen to WDEV here, as you listen to other radio outlets, it's still very important. I also think it's the most imaginative media. Television is very important. Radio is always closest to my heart. It's how we began. But, you know, most people get their news, although it's changing with the Internet, from television. So it wasn't up to us to say, you come to us. We wanted to go where people were. And so we started on television, and that just picked up very, very quickly. But then the Internet is absolutely critical for all of this. And unlike the networks, we started with the Internet as soon as we were doing radio, because we had no money. And it was our way of sending broadcast-quality radio broadcasts to other stations. And then we were doing TV. We pioneered a way of sending broadcast quality video through the Internet. So now in Sweden and two different cities and Stockholm and Gothenburg, they play us twice a day on television. And we broadcast in South Africa, throughout Latin America, because the Internet is open and free, except that's being challenged now. I just 2 days ago was down in Washington. I understand Senator Warren is going to be coming here to give a speech, and I was at the Public Citizen Gala where she was also speaking, and I had come for that, since I was coming to Washington, I stopped by the FCC because there was a people's firewall that had been erected. People were holding an encampment outside the FCC because the Federal Communications Commission is making key decisions right now. Now it's public comment period, so you can all weigh in on whether network neutrality will continue. And network neutrality is simply the concept that the Internet is open and free for everyone, that there isn't a two-tiered system where for some companies that can afford it, they will have a faster highway than the slower highways. Already it's the consumers that are paying to be on the Internet. They want to charge it both ways. It's been developed with our public money. And now when corporations recognize how unbelievably valuable the Internet is, they want to privatize it. And what that'll mean is, you know, Google.com, ATT.com, you know, you go to them, you go right to them. DemocracyNow.org might take you about 10 minutes. Some Dalit woman's website in India you might never, or website a kid makes in a garage right here in Stowe, you might never be able to access. And that's not acceptable. It's our way of grassroots globalizing. The corporations have always been able to do it. You know, they have the money to globalize. But the way we can all communicate with each other is through the Internet. There's still a digital divide, those who can afford to be on the Internet and those who can't. But around the world, we can communicate with each other, and we have to fight for that. You know, this is democracy at work, and we never achieve democracy. We have to fight for it every single day. You can never rest, sadly. And that's certainly true now when it comes to the Internet. So I hope you pay particular attention to legislation around the Internet. There's a whole media democracy movement in this country that is extremely important because The media is the way we learn about the world and the way the rest of the world learns about us, and it has to be through something other than a corporate lens and a corporate microphone. And we have to be able to do it as easily, as freely communicating with each other, and it must not all be funneled through corporations.
Well, that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We've been listening to a recording of the Vermont Town Hall public conversation that I had with Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, and my sister. You can hear the full unedited version of this show by going to vbsr.org/click on the Vermont Conversation tab, and we'll have the unedited version online. Talk to you next week on the Vermont Conversation.
AP Radio.